Sorry about that. Technical difficulties getting started. Hopefully you can hear me. And recordings will work. So, last time, I believe we started by talking about one last remaining security topic, which was capabilities. This is the idea that rather than having access control list that we sort of checked on the side, that we were trying to access a thing, and at the beginning of the code that to access the thing in the kernel would be a check for, are you really allowed to do this? Rather than doing that, we'd have the way you identify the thing you're trying to access tell you whether or not you can do this. And we saw that we already have seen an example of this with file descriptors, that when you get a token to access a file, a file descriptor, that's when they check whether you can access the file is done. And then that means later on, like when we're implementing read or write, we can't make the mistake of accidentally letting you access a file you're not supposed to access because that check was already done in the open. We can apply that same sort of process to other sorts of resources and even to opening other files and directories to make an OS design where we have this sort of permission checking, but we don't have access control list on the side, which are arguably like error prone and sort of inelegant as far as things we need to do in the kernel. So then we talked a bit about virtual machines. We mentioned sort of terminology. We talked about having a host OS where the hypervisor would run and a guest OS, which is running inside the virtual machine. And we mentioned that a bunch of this process was similar to running a normal process, but the process was the guest OS and everything it was running. And we track things like the current registers, the current memory, the current things it has available to access. So same as kind of idea as a process control block. We needed some extra information to emulate features of the real hardware. The biggest one was we needed to pretend there was a kernel mode for the guest OS, even though in reality, you know, we would be running the guest OS entirely in user mode. So we need to track, does the guest OS believe it's in kernel mode? We need to track information that the real processor would track for the OS running in kernel mode, like its page table pointer, its exception table pointer, because our hypervisor was emulating all that functionality. And sort of our key emulation technique was we'd hope or make sure operations that were special, meaning basically that they didn't just naturally do the right thing because we needed to emulate some different functionality, and the guest OS would trigger an exception. So this would usually include things like IOs, updating things to support kernel mode, like the exception table or the page table base pointer, performing system calls, all these things we wanted to behave differently on the real hardware would trigger an exception, and the hypervisor and host OS exception handler could, instead of, you know, like we would in a normal OS, say, oh, you're trying to access kernel-only stuff? Don't do that. We could emulate what the real hardware would do. So we'd, you know, say, if guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode, let's pretend to do what the real hardware would do, pretend to talk to that keyboard, even if we're talking to a file, you know, pretend to update the page table, but really do something more complicated, and so on. And we also needed to support exceptions that, you know, our real hardware exception handler would run the host OS. Sometimes we wanted to actually run the guest OS, so we need to reflect the exceptions back to the guest OS. Our second big thing we need to deal with virtual machines was implementing page tables. And I talked about one technique for doing this, which was shadow page tables, where we'd build a page table for the real hardware, which was kind of a shadow, you know, of the guest page table. It was taken by, you know, projecting the guest page table through the hypervisor page table. And we mentioned a strategy for managing this was that we could fill it in on demand, and we could figure out when we needed to update this based on when the guest OS tried to flush the TLB. Because when the guest OS tries to flush the TLB, that's it saying, I updated my page table, and when it updates this page table, we need to update the real hardware page table. And this gave us a way to do this. I also mentioned that, well, we need to emulate some extra functionality, like the kernel-only bit in page tables. And the simplest technique for doing that, which was kind of unsatisfying, was basically to have two page tables, depending on whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not. Because the hardware is not going to have a natural way for us to indicate, you know, hey, ignore the kernel mode only bit temporarily. But not always. So the easiest way to present that to the hardware is multiple page tables. So, as I mentioned last time, I'm going to take just questions for exam review. So these would be questions on things we covered last time. These can be questions on any other topics. So I'll just take those questions. I'll take a whole bunch of questions, and then I'll go through them in some order. I'll probably take them mainly in the text chat, because I think taking them via voice would be a little bit high overhead. And if there's no questions, we'll have a very quick day. Sure. So device driver flow. Okay. Other things. Want me to talk about? I'm surprised that I'm not getting more. Okay, page caching. Can we be more specific about page caching? But hard performance. Okay. Page like inode-based file systems and fragments, do we just want, like, fragments are one topic. Do we actually want inode-based file systems specifically separate from that? I guess double, triple, indirect blocks probably is the big thing people might be confused about with inode-based file systems. Number of needed file size. So page cache mapping. And sockets. Okay. I think this is a reasonable start, so I'll go, I've sorted thing, and can we be more specific than access control and thread scheduling? Just because if you're not more specific, I'm afraid I'm going to give like this super general overview that won't answer what you're actually worried about knowing. Okay. And POSIX access control. Okay. Those are definitely more specific things, which I probably wouldn't have mentioned, basically going over them. Okay. So let's start with page caching. I might do a second round of questions if we have time. So the page cache. So like, let's go with the high level idea of the page cache is that we want to keep program data and file data mostly in memory, but we want a fallback, mostly because we want mostly because we want a final logistics. Oh. So we want to keep the data mostly in memory, mostly, I say, because, you know, we want to, you know, have a place on disk or for the data, and can store on disk, you know, when not loaded yet, can store on disk if not enough space in memory. So basically, sort of idea with the page cache is ideally, like, all our data would always be in memory, but we can't really do that. And we're going to do this for program data and file data. So this means, you know, everything. So this is includes program data, everything that's in a program's memory. And file data is everything in a regular file. We're going to keep all that stuff in memory, ideally, because that's going to be a lot faster. But we can't always do that. And to maintain this, we have some components that we need some way to look up, given something I want to access, where is it in memory? And this is what I call the forward mapping. And we have sort of two cases. If it's part of a process's address space, then this is going to be in the page table. It has to be in the page table because we don't want to involve having OS code run if we don't need so. And the page table can be managed by the processor without the OS getting involved. If it's part of a file being read with system calls, some OS data structure is going to tell us, hey, you're reading this file, this is where this part of this file is. So we also need a way of looking up, so this is forward mapping cache hit, I'll say. Given something I want to access, where is it on disk? We might need this because it's not in memory yet, for example. And we call this a cache miss because sort of memory is our cache. So if it's part of this address space, varies. So this varies, you know, some OS data structure attached to process to the PCB. It's part of a file being read with system calls based on how the file system works. So like we know where the directory is and get a cluster number, it was fat, we get an inode, which would have a list of locations. It was an inode-based file system, but that's sort of how we figure it out in that case. So these are sort of the obvious cases of where we need to look things up, because I want to access something, where do I get it? And that's what I meant by forward mapping. So we also, you know, more subtly, also need a way to look up, given something I know is in memory, where are there pointers to it? And this is what I called a reverse mapping. And the reason we need this is a bit more subtle, but you know, where we store this information, so we need some sort of OS data structure for everything kept in the in memory in the cache. And we needed this information because when memory is full, we need to unset pointers to free up more memory for something else. So if everything in memory is in use and we want to bring something new into memory, we need to unset some pointers, which means we need to find the pointers, which means we need that mapping. And this process is called page replacement. So that brings us to page replacement algorithms. So page replacement algorithms equals a way to choose what thing to replace when memory is full. Memory is full, and we need to bring in something new. And sort of the key intuition is usually, well, I guess let's go through the sort of the theoretical we started with. You know, sort of the theoretical best is replace whatever is going to be accessed never again or furthest in the future. Whichever, you know, if there's nothing never again, something furthest in the future. So that's the theoretical best. Just the ladies, men. But we can't actually do that. So sort of practical ideas are assume things that haven't been accessed recently won't be accessed later. Accessed for a long time. This gives us the least recently used policy. So that's sort of our Bain practical idea. And if this assumption is true... So, this assumption is true. It's enough to track they have been accessed recently without being precise. And we talked about a bunch of ways, you know, example, second chance, policy, look for something which hasn't been accessed since we added it to a list of pages. And we talked about a whole bunch of different policies that sort of have this property that they're looking for something which hasn't been accessed recently, and, you know, various choices about sort of what time spans we look for accesses in. Talked about a bunch of policies which have that flavor of look for accesses in some short time window and make sure it hasn't happened so we know it hasn't been accessed recently. So it works with this assumption that if it hasn't been accessed recently, it won't be accessed for a long time. That assumption. Sort of. And we mentioned that sometimes the assumption above is false. We can have heuristics for those cases. And some OSs look for particular cases where those assumptions are false. For one example, things were only going to access one, going to access once. And have heuristics, meaning guesses, for those cases rather than using that assumption. So I have a feeling I may have not gone over something people wanted me to go over with page replacement algorithms in this brief overview. Is there anything here needs clarification? Okay, so let's move on to device driver flow. So we mentioned that the device driver, there are two components to the device driver. So we had what I called the top half, which is the part run from system calls, etc. You know, this is, and this sets up the IO operation. And the bottom half, which is the part, the interrupt handler. This is triggered by the device and finishes the IO operation. And, you know, our general pattern is that a process makes a read or write call, top half executes and checks if it can, if it already has the data for the read-write, because the bottom half fills in a buffer typically. Typically, buffer containing data from to device. If it doesn't, it puts the process sleep. While the process is sleeping, other things can happen, like other processes can run. Device triggers interrupt when read-write is finished. Bottom half. Completes the I/O operation, e.g. typically updates buffer. Half wakes up process doing the read-write call. Meaning makes it eligible for scheduling, it may or may not run right away. And so that's the general pattern. And I mentioned sometimes top half might need to run multiple times to do a very big reader write. So if we write 100 megabytes, maybe each time the device does something, it only handles a megabyte. In which case, we'll just do this over and over again. When the top half is woken up, then it will check again and say, oh, I need to queue some more data or, get some more data. So questions about this device driver flow? Okay, so then SSD versus HDD performance. So with hard disks, sort of the big performance issue is that the head, the thing that reads physically from the spinning platters, needs to move to the right location. So it's important, it's useful / important, try to keep data you want to access together close physically on the disk. And to help us with this, help OSs, etc., do this, HDDs assign sector numbers so that nearby sector numbers are close on the disk. So with SSDs, solid-state disks, there are no moving parts, so physical location doesn't matter very much. And it really, in fact, really doesn't matter because the SSD doesn't place data in the physical locations. In physical locations, the OS knows about. The OS just knows the sector numbers. They have actually very little correlation to where the SSD puts things. So because of this, it doesn't really matter exactly where you put data. Sort of the big concerns for performance are that SSDs, generally fast read-write, the big performance problem comes from needing to clear up space. This has to be done in erasure blocks. Data has to be copied to make sure a whole erasure block can be erased. And because of that, that has a cost. And that's where we can have our big performance issues. And this, happens in the device. OS doesn't generally get to know about it. Except for slowness. Okay. Any questions on hard disk, solid state versus hard disks thing? Okay, so then we have a whole bunch of things on inode-based file systems and so on. So let's talk generally about the design of an inode-based file system. So we have a header, we have an array of inodes, we have a bitmap, you know, array of bools is data block free and data blocks. This is sort of our design. This is without block groups. We have that. We have, this is the layout of the disk. And the inodes are, this is where we store information about files. Files, so their size, their owner, permissions, and where the first several data blocks are located is in the array of inodes. And that's what's stored there. So the inodes are fixed sized, that's so we can have an array. And so for small files, we just have a list of where the first data blocks are. Now, where things get tricky is when we don't have enough space in the inode for all the information. So inode has information on, inode directly contains the block numbers indexed into the data blocks part of the disk of first few blocks of data. So example, if an inode has 10 direct, and we call these direct block pointers, direct block pointers, then and blocks, data block blocks are say 2k, then the first 20k of the file can be found using those 10 pointers. So where we run into a problem is that, well, some files are going to be bigger than 20k. So what do we do about them? And we have this sort of approach where we get more and more indirection. After that, so more and more indirection depending on how big the file is. So let's say example inode has one indirect pointer after the 10 pointer, after 10 direct. So then bytes 20k through, and we'll figure out what the size is, are found using that indirect pointer. And well, how much does the indirect pointer? So 0.2. So the indirect pointer points to a block. A block, which is 2k. The block contains an array of block pointers. So how big? If block pointers are 4 bytes, then 2k divided by 4 bytes, which is going to be 512. No, just the size of an array is the size, total size divided by number elements in an array is the total size divided by the size of each element. Well, elements. So each of those elements points to a block, which implies that they, you know, so that in total, this can point to 512 times 2k, which is going to be, right, 1024k in those blocks. And these blocks are, that will contain data for the file. So this means that bytes 20k through 1024 plus 20k, which is equal to 1044k, are found using the direct pointer. But, you know, what if, you know, 144K isn't big enough? Then the inode might have a double indirect pointer. And the double indirect pointer points to a block, which contains 5 or 12 pointers. Those pointers point to each point to a block, which contains 512 pointers. And those pointers point to blocks that will contain data for the file. So this is our, you know, pointers, and these we can say are pointers. We can say that the 512 pointers, the double indirect pointers to, are indirect pointers, and then these 512 pointers, the indirect pointers to, are direct pointers. We like to remove a level of indirection at each level. So we end up with, so 512 times 512 times 2k of data for the file, those blocks, you know, at the last level, which is going to be, let me take it out, my calculator, so right to K of data. So, that means that bytes 1044K through 1044K plus 524288K will be found through, are found using that double indirect pointer. And the triple indirect is similar, we just have another layer, you know, of indentation here. And this also sort of gets at our blocks needed file size calculation. So, sort of, I guess the key thing that people miss is that if we're, you know, if we use the indirect block, that doesn't mean that all the pointers in the indirect block are needed. So, example with above, if the file is 24K, we need two pointers in the block indirect block. We have the one for 20 to 22K, one for 22 to 24K. If the file is 1048K, we need one pointer in the double indirect block for 1044 to, we determined to 2064K, and one pointer in the block that pointer points to, or sorry, not one, but four pointer, double indirect, indirect. Okay. One pointer in the block that pointer points to. One pointer, four pointers. Four pointers, because 448, I can divide it, two pointers. So one for 1044 to 1046K, and one for 1046 to 1048K. Notice that we, even though this double indirect block and the first points has a lot of extra space, we can't, you don't use all of it because we don't need to point to that many data blocks. That's, I think, the big thing that people kind of forget when thinking about this sort of tree structure, that we don't need to fill out the part of the tree where we don't need data, that much data. So questions about this overview of indirect, double indirect blocks, things that are confusing here, I should try to explain differently. So in the last example, if our file is 1,048K, that the first 1,044K use the indirect block and all its 512 pointers. Let's just do this. More clearly, the first 20k use the direct pointers, next 1024k use the indirect block, then we have 4k left over. But we need to use the double indirect pointer next. Because that's what we have next. We have a double indirect pointer because the inode's not going to change what type of pointers it has. We need to use the double indirect pointer next. And this is even though we only want to point to two blocks of data. So to do this, we have the double indirect pointer point to a block with one useful pointer. Then that useful pointer points to a, useful indirect pointer. And that indirect, useful indirect pointer points to a block with two useful pointers. Two useful direct pointers. And we need to do that because we need to use a double indirect block to get this extra two blocks. Does that answer your question? Or clarify things? Some people are doing private questions. Hopefully that also clarifies the private question, which you could have asked publicly. So in this case, what would the total number of blocks be? The total number of blocks. Sure. So let's do the total number of blocks. So of data, we have 1,028.4 divided by 2k. So that's 1,048 divided by 2k, which is 5,524 blocks of data, plus one indirect block, one block of pointers pointed to by the indirect block in the inode, plus one block of indirect pointers pointed to by the double indirect block in the inode, plus one block of direct pointers pointed to by the first entry in the double indirect block in the inode, which indeed is 527. Okay, that answer, that, I think, any other questions about this? So the double indirect points to indirect and direct. So the double indirect points to a block of indirect pointers, which point to a block of direct pointers. We always end up with the direct pointer at the bottom of the chain. And we only go down one level each time. We don't have more flexibility than that. Does that answer your question? So the question is, I have another block of direct pointers. Yes. So the double indirect block point. The double indirect pointer in the inode for both of these So the double indirect pointer in the inode can only point to a block of indirect pointers. But to actually represent file data, we need a block of direct pointers. So the way we do that is we allocate a block of indirect pointers so we can point to a block of direct pointers. Because indirect pointers can point to a block of direct pointers. Does that answer your question? Or clarify things? So question, the two blocks of direct pointers are the same? No, they aren't. So this block, the first block of direct pointers, it points to where bytes 20K through 1044K of the file's data are. And this block points to where bytes 1044K through 1048K of the file's data are. So they have better. So they have to have different contents. Okay. So then the question was about fragments. So for very small files, we might not want to allocate a whole block of data. So our solution, a solution for this is divide blocks into smaller pieces, but only use those smaller pieces for small files. So the fragments are the smaller pieces. And why only for small files if we use smaller pieces block sizes for large files, then we'd add a lot more block pointers. And that would be wasteful. Okay. That's on fragments. So questions on fragments? The question is, can a block contain fragments for different directories? Yes. So these smaller pieces, we can, as long as everyone's using a smaller piece, yes, we can combine them for multiple files, and that's sort of where the big space advantage is. And we, there's no real restriction saying where these different fragments have to come from, other than that they have to be from small files. So then question on sockets. So sockets, when set up, act like double-ended pipes. People who know more about sockets may realize I'm kind of glossing over a special case here. But basically they act like double-ended pipes. Can write on one end of the socket, read on the other end. Other end, and vice versa. Like a pipe, double-ended pipes with file descriptors for each end. I shouldn't say double-ended. I should say two-way pipes for each end. So it's because pipes already have two ends. So it's a two-way pipe. You can write on any end, read on the other end, and that works when you're set up. And the setup process is we need to specify on the client the address, and this is address plus port number, sometimes called a socket address to connect to. And on the server, the address plus port number to listen for connections on. So that's the setup process. And so on the client, this is done with socket, create file descriptor, get adder info, France Lite human readable address, you know, name plus host name, you know, like virginia.edu plus service name to socket address, and then connect make file descriptor access that socket address, that a server using that socket address. So those are the operations. On the server, you call socket to create a server socket file descriptor. Then we call bind to set the address plus, and I should say we call get, or then call bind to set the address plus port number using a socket address we get using the same kind of procedure. Then we call listen to tell the OS to expect connections. Then we call accept to get a new file descriptor for the next client that connects. And we can call accept in a loop for multiple clients. And that's why we have this separate server socket, so we can handle multiple clients but still have one file descriptor for each client we're talking to. So when we write to that file descriptor, we know who it's going to. This answer people's questions? So, a next issue is that distributed system failure cases. So, our main failure model assumed for machines fail stop, meaning either the machine works or it's as if powered off. So it might not really be powered off, but it's like the same as if it lost power. As if powered off, can remember things in spite of failure by writing to disk carefully. That was sort of our main failure model. This is obviously not actually realistic because, yes, things fail in other ways. Our main failure model assumed for networks, we'd have lost messages plus reordering. So lost messages means you send a message and it doesn't get there sometimes. And this includes you send a message and it does get there, but the acknowledgement that it got there, but the reply message doesn't get there. Message doesn't get to you. That's kind of just a special case of messages being lost, that, you know, when you send a message, you're not going to know whether or not it got there. Because the only way you can know is by getting some reply saying, yes, it got there. And that's not guaranteed. Reordered messages are, you send a message A, then a message B, and message A, message B arrives first. And this includes you send message A and wait so long and, wait long enough to assume it's not getting there. And then message B arrives first, then message A. So I have a feeling this is not what the person who asked for me to go over this wanted me to go over. Might be something about handling these failures, but guess we'll get back to that. Yeah. So, okay. So then we have guest OS versus host OS exceptions. So when a guest OS is running, everything, you know, the only exception handler on the real hardware is the host OS's. Because the real hardware doesn't know it's running a virtual machine. At least in the model of virtual machines we talked about without special hardware support. So this means that every exception is a host OS exception. So let's talk about causes of host OS exceptions when a guest OS is running. So one cause is the guest OS did something that would have triggered an exception if the guest OS wasn't in a VM. So examples of this include talking to an I/O device, an I/O device requesting something to happen, or making a system call, or accessing memory that is invalid in a page table. A whole bunch of other cases. In any of these cases, if it would have happened if the guest OS wasn't in a VM, inside a VM, our VM, because it wants to pretend, make the guest OS, so the guest OS shouldn't need to know it's in a VM, should run the guest OS's exception handler from the host OS exception handler. Another cause is the guest OS did something that would have done something other than triggering an exception if the guest OS wasn't an AVM. An example, this is talking to an I/O device, via memory mapped I/O, asking to change the page table base pointer, asking to disable interrupts, asking to change the exception table address, asking to switch from kernel to user mode. These are all things which if the guest OS wasn't in VM, would have done some operation. So the VM should emulate the operation the guest OS would have done outside of VM. For this first rear case. That's like a questionable case. But you see, the basic idea is that if it would have triggered an exception outside, if the guest OS wasn't in a VM, we want it to still trigger an exception so the guest OS doesn't know the difference. And if it wouldn't have, we don't want to trigger an exception, but we want to emulate the thing that should have happened instead of an exception if the guest OS wasn't in a VM. Questions about these? question is, what thread scheduler policy makes sense when? So we have different metrics we might have cared about. So one metric was response time. I guess I should do turnaround time slash wait time. I was careful to avoid the term response time because it means multiple things, which is, so turnaround time is from when a program becomes runnable until when it stops being runnable. And this is if the program is a loop of wait for input, process input, then this reflects how interactive the program is. That's why it was a useful metric. And the optimal algorithm for this was SRTF, shortest min first. The practical algorithm was approximations, SRTF, that estimate the remaining time somehow. Usual estimate is based on past amounts of time used when runnable. So it's one idea. So then we had this, another big sort of very different metric we had was fairness. And this is sort of whether, you know, multiple programs users, you know, get to use the same amount of CPU or have the same ability to access the CPU. And we had a bunch of algorithms which did different takes on this. So round robin said, okay, you know, when you're runnable, same ability, access CPU, but we don't do anything, we don't care about when you're not runnable. We also had the Linux CFS, the virtual time idea, which was same CPU over time, same total amount of CPU usage over time with some configurable options for over how much time. Because if it was over all time, then, you know, because we don't, you know, want to worry about what happened, you know, minutes, hours, days ago. Because if we equalize your CPU usage over a month, then that would cause weird things to happen if you only started running on the 30th of the month. Have this compromise where it's overtime, but a relatively small time window. And the other big option we had was throughput, which was, you know, amount of compute time used for actual stuff, actual work, not figuring out what to do. And this was something like first come, first serve, because it was the simplest scheduling decision and plus minimal context switches. And these are both things where we're figuring out what to do or starting, stopping programs. And those are both things where, which we called overhead. So I think these were the main I cared about. There's some other possible metrics that are less important. And basically what Scheduler policy you want to choose, like the general idea is you want to choose based on, you know, what metrics do you actually care about. And if you care about different mix of metrics than these, like if you care about a mix of turnaround time and fairness, then, you know, you might need a different algorithm than any of the ones I have listed. And I guess maybe I should mention, well, Lottery was kind of in the fairness category. Though I think CFS is basically, most of the times, a better version of what that's trying to accomplish. Okay, so POSIX access control. So POSIX has sort of two mechanisms for specifying file access control, which is generally what we've cared about. So there's the historic mechanism. Files have an owner, user ID, a group ID, and what are called mode bits, specifying can owner read / read the file, can the owner write the file, can the owner execute the file, and the same thing for the group. And can anyone else? And the same thing for anyone else. Else, and implicitly, the owner can always change all this information. So that's the historical mechanism, and we can view this as an access control list, but with very limited. Features. A less supported, much more flexible mechanism called POSIX ACLs, which are, real access control lists, you might say. And this is have a list of user ID, can user ID read, write, execute, group ID, can group ID read, write, execute, of any number of, and so on. So that's just much more flexible and default can not non-specified user group read, write, execute. And for either of these, checked on open, rename, remove, etc., based on the user and group ID be stored in the process control block of whoever makes a file-related system call. The question is, can anyone besides root and the file owner change permissions? Ordinarily not. The question is, how is the ACL stored? I don't actually, I have some idea, but it varies between file systems. So this probably requires special file system support. So the file system probably needs to provide some place to store all this information. And usually, this is usually stored in inodes. For this one and the general ACLs, the inode file system needs to provide a place to store this. And if you think about storing in the inodes, this any number is a real problem. So we need some more dynamic way of doing that. And that's one reason why it's less commonly supported. Okay, so final logistics. So I don't have the final entirely written. I have a whole bunch of questions that I need to go through them, try to have my try to see if I can convince my TAs to audit them to make sure they're sane and make sure they cover the set of topics I want to cover. But the basic plan is that I'm going to release a document of questions and an answer template document. The answer template will be a text file with fill in the blank areas. You'll upload that text file after filling it in into Kytos. This is because I think anything that would involve actually scanning things or printing things out seems like a total disaster because, you know, I don't want to assume you're going to get a printer and scanner working with any remote sense of reliability. So I just don't think that's practical. And I want to give a template text file, so hopefully I can have, like, distinct question boundary markers so I can have a script that divides it up by question. So TAs will read what you've put for each question, at least for cases where, you know, it's not something like multiple choice, which I think will have to be a bunch of questions, you know, and read what you put there. And we can separate it out by question so a TA can just go through, like, all the question ones. And I mentioned in the earlier email, like, the plan is to release it, like, you know, slightly before our scheduled final time and expect you to upload the response within 24 hours. And we can talk about exceptions for that if you have some sort of circumstance that's going to make it hard to do that. Is the exam cumulative? The exam, you'll notice, is worth 15%. 15%, same as the midterm. Midterm, it will focus on material from after the midterm. There probably will be some coverage of topics before the midterm, but not much, which is kind of like prior semester's finals you can see posted. But because it's worth the same as the midterm, I don't think it really makes sense to make it truly cumulative. It's kind of a deliberate choice. Okay, so I have 5 minutes, so I can take... how long will we have to work on the final? I'm not going to pretend I can enforce time limits, but I want it to be, so I'm not going to try. I intend it to be of a similar length to the midterm, maybe a little bit longer. Which means it shouldn't take you the entire 24 hours. Can I go over time to check to time of use? Sure. So this is time of check to time of use. So this is a security problem that occurs. We separate the check of an access control list or similar from actually accessing an item. And the form of the problem is that, so an example is that, like, you have a privilege program, you say, example I gave is, you know, a print file program that runs as root. And the timeline would be the print file. So the timeline would be the attacker. So calls the print file program on, you know, example. Example of that text. And then the print file program checks that the attacker is allowed to access example.txt. The attacker then moves secret.txt, moves or links or makes a moves links, makes a symbolic link of secret.txt to example.txt. print file program accesses and prints example.txt. Example.txt, which is now a different file. And the problem is that this was the check and this was the use. And sort of the solution. So one solution is print file program opens file, checks using the file descriptor. File descriptor won't change what file it refers to because of rename, symbolic link, etc. operation. Another solution is print file program opens file in a way which checks if attacker can access file. And this avoids the problem because the check So both solutions combine check and use in some way. Ensure it's always the same file. So I gave you this example with files. This also occurs with other things. Non-files. So example is kill PID 1000 kernel system call implementation attacker PID 10,000 ker. Set so this can occur in the kernel, for example. If the kernel has a separate check where it says, oh, can you kill PID 10,000? Yes, you can. And then it doesn't actually kill PID 10,000, but it might be different than the one checked. And the solution is look up, make sure what PID 10,000 is doesn't change between check and, use to kill it. So this is a common pattern of vulnerabilities when you're trying to implement sort of access control list type checks. Is that answer your question? Why are there 10 reads on the latest quiz? Because of the amount it's reading at a time, and because there's no caching, you can't do a larger read and then get parts of it. You have to read each time because you can't cache between the reads. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so there's 1,024 KB, but you read 128K at a time. Oh, yep, I can't count. Okay, yes, I was doing crazy base 10 math. I will change the quiz key for that. Yes, that is just me doing things in the wrong base. Other questions before I close up shop? Does it not need to close the file? There is no close operation in NFS version 2 because the server doesn't remember what files the client has open, I think. Am I remembering the question correctly? Let me make sure I'm remembering the question correctly. Yeah, it's NFS version 2. NFS version 2, the client just has a file ID, and the server doesn't know when the client forgets about the file ID. So that answer your question? And I think that's where I'll stop for today. And...